Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV
One. Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, millions still without power all across the Southeast as a result of Hurricane Irma. 16 storm-related deaths have been reported on the U.S. mainland. We'll be joined by an NBC reporter live from Miami to give us a breakdown of what's happening in the Sunshine State. Six Baltimore cops involved in the arrest and the death of Freddie Gray, not facing any federal charges. No shock there. We'll talk with family attorney William Billy Murphy. Also on the show, a black man on death row in Georgia will be executed this month. But his case shows clear racial bias when one of the jurors said he didn't know if black folks have souls. Really? We'll talk about that in the simulcast of time during the morning show. It's time to bring the funk. News One Now on TV One. Hurricane Irma is affecting so many Americans, 5 million without power. It could be weeks before it is restored in Florida, as well as other states near that particular state. Let's go to Miami, where NBC reporter Sarah Rosario joins us right now. And Sarah, clearly people are dealing with the aftermath. It wasn't as bad as expected, but without power in the heat in Florida, not good.
Right, Roland, you got it exactly right. Here in Miami, we saw a lot of flooding at the height of the storm. That has since receded. But what we are seeing is downed trees all across the city, like the ones you see behind me. But the dire need right now is in the Florida Keys, where that storm rolled through the area as a Category 4 hurricane, and it just caused widespread devastation. Recovery expected to take months, if not years, turning that island into what many used to believe was a tropical paradise. Now it looks more like a war zone. Homes ripped off their foundations, roads washed away, complete neighborhoods reduced to rubble. Now the Navy, medical responders flown into that area yesterday. They are hard at work trying to help people in any way possible, providing much needed supplies. The USS Abraham Lincoln, a warship now on a mission of mercy, able to provide 100,000 gallons of water to people in the Keys per day. This as search and rescue teams continue to go through the area to try to find people unaccounted for, also looking for anybody who just may be stranded. The effects of Irma are being felt all across the Southeast, even still. From the Carolinas, where they have flooding in the streets, to Jacksonville, Florida, where historic flooding there is expected to last up until possibly even next week. There is some good news here. Florida Power and Light, the largest utility provider here in Florida, says we could have our lights back turned back on by this weekend. And for the west coast of Florida, it could be within the next 10 days. So some good news there, Roland. Live in Miami, Sarah Rosario. Back to you.
All right, Sarah, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Again, folks, we're still seeing the aftermath, not only what's happening in the United States, the mainland, but also what's happening, of course, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as other Caribbean nations as well. People are impacted in a negative way, but the British Virgin Islands destroyed even more so than the U.S. Virgin Islands. Some 100,000 Americans stranded in the U.S. Virgin Islands. The question is, what will this country do to assist them? Our panel, Spencer Overton, president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, Angela Saylor, deputy to the chairman for the Gloucester Institute, Dr. Greg Carr, chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. Spencer, when these things happen, we only think in terms of just the mainland. But right. When you look at Puerto Rico, right. When you look at U.S. Virgin Islands, those are territories.
Right.
Those are American citizens.
Those are Americans, right? And we don't want to forget about them. So much has been focused on Florida, obviously very important, in other states here. And they talk about, you know, a certain number of deaths on the mainland. Hey, there are Americans who died in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. There was an op-ed in today's New York Times making that very point. Sister from the Virgin Islands, and have a lot of students who are not only from the U.S. Virgin Islands. Yesterday, I talked to a young man whose people are from St. Martin, and they lost 95% of their housing stock. And so he was concerned. All his family's coming to D.C. to stay with him for the indeterminable future. Not to mention, Roland, interestingly enough, in your hometown in Houston, man, they tested around the Clayton homes the other day, the New York Times, because the EPA wouldn't give them any information. Those folks have 135 times the acceptable amount of E. coli. And Texas A&M is putting a team together because they found mercury beads in the water. So, I mean, as we're dealing with the Caribbean, as we're dealing with Florida, let's not forget that the aftermath of these storms is what really now we're really going to have to face.
And Angela, I mean, again, environmental disasters, we talk about natural disasters, but then you have this that, again, very much affects people in a negative way. Now you're talking about sickness and illness.
Yes, absolutely. And when we look at, you know, what's going to be happening on the Hill with an infrastructure package, I mean, now with all this devastation, infrastructure is absolutely needed. And I am just, my heart just really goes out to all the Americans who have really been coming together over this disaster and praying and doing what they can to help and looking at how government and just private citizens are working to make sure that all of them, that our American brothers and sisters are going to make it through this disaster.
All right. Speaking of disaster, that's what people are saying in Baltimore, where federal officials have decided there will be no federal charges for the six Baltimore cops involved in the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray. The Justice Department announced the decision on Tuesday, but did not offer an explanation. It was in April of 2015 when the officers handcuffed and dragged Freddie Gray into a police transport van. He died of a broken neck he suffered while riding unrestrained in that van. His death sparked days of unrest in Baltimore. Now, all six officers were charged by prosecutor Marilyn Mosby. Three were acquitted, and the state dropped the other cases. But next month, public trials will be held for the five of the officers to determine whether they keep their jobs with Baltimore's police department. Joining me via FaceTime from Baltimore is William Billy Murphy, the attorney for the Gray family. Billy, I don't know if anyone actually expected the Department of Justice to file civil rights charges because of their unwillingness to do so in previous cases. And also, as former Attorney General Eric Holder said, the high standard that must be met when it comes to civil rights violations.
Yes, that's true. And good morning, Roland. And it's nice to be back. It is true that the expectations were low. But what I find disturbing about the whole thing is that we're getting ready to have public trials of all five of these officers in terms of disciplinary proceedings conducted by the police department. And it is rumored that one of the officers is actually cooperating with the investigation. And to put it the way I heard it, he came clean. Now, why would you announce that you are not investigating these police on the eve of those hearings? Somebody hasn't been paying attention, or there's a certain indifference to this prosecution that settled in from the beginning. There are things about this I really don't understand.
Well, and to your point, if you wait until after these discipline trials, things may come out in there that could aid your federal investigation.
Well, that's correct. And they claim to have been thorough in their approach. And this is the furthest thing from thorough. Who would not want to see the outcome of a public set of four disciplinary trials where one officer is not being charged with any discipline because he may have been cooperating? Who wouldn't want to see that if you're a prosecutor? So they could say, I did it. I confess. Please forgive me. Unlikely. But what if that happened after they've decided not to prosecute this man?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very puzzling turn of events. And I don't know what we call the Sessions factor. I just don't know the extent to which his new attitude about these things and Trump's new attitude about these things is playing a role. Now, many of these people in Maine Justice are career people who cannot be fired by this administration except for cause. So I don't know what to think. Now, the other thing that's curious, Roland, is that I know a good bit about this case. I've been involved in it from the beginning. No one's reached out to me to say, What do you know? Tell us everything, or anything of that nature. That's odd. If there was a civil lawyer in any other prosecution who had the knowledge about this case that I do, they would come to me. They would come to that lawyer. What's the downside? The other thing is they did this in secret. So they announced publicly at the end that they didn't find anything. They want to talk to the parents, or they wanted to before this became public, but the Sun papers in Baltimore beat them to it. And why care so much to talk to folk who know stuff and not talk to them until it's all over? I just don't get it.
All right, Attorney Billy Murphy, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Roland.
Spencer, as Eric Holder said, that it is such a high standard to prosecute for civil rights violations.
Right.
It is as if these cops consistently, not just in Baltimore, are getting away with murder.
Right, that's absolutely right. And this accountability piece is key. You know, we can talk about structural reforms, but holding individual officers accountable is key. And it really doesn't help when the Attorney General makes political statements and basically says, hey, we need to err more on the side and give these cops more leeway. And the president says things like, you know,
putting too much stress on the officers.
Right, exactly. And so we don't know the full legitimacy of this decision in terms of DOJ. There's kind of a credibility question because politics are at play. We don't know whether or not to trust it.
And again, we saw, Angela, where we had in the Obama Justice Department an unwillingness to prosecute cases. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, when I moderated the town hall at Congressional Black Caucus a couple of years ago, she said DOJ should take some chances when it comes to prosecuting some of these cases and not just go, we don't think we can, get a conviction, so we're not even going to try.
Well, I mean, I think the American people deserve to see some consistency from the state and from the federal government on these issues. And I even think police officers need to see some more consistency in terms of what's expected of them. And we keep talking about train the officers and, you know, they need sensitivity training, but even training and not having a consistent punishment or assistant way to deliberate the conflict just creates a lot of mismessaging, and it continues to develop these racial tensions that we're experiencing.
Yeah, Greg, because at the end of the day, if you don't have any accountability, people don't believe the system is protecting its citizens.
That's exactly right. We've got to change this paradigm, and we have these conversations about being surprised or bemused. It's clear. There's a sliding scale on the value of human life in America, and black people are at the bottom of that sliding scale.
Right.
In Minnesota, when the white woman is shot, the police chief resigns, the Somali cat is immediately suspended. What we're seeing is different lives mean different value. That's why Jeff Sessions was never going to quit. This is his dream job. He is a white supremacist, and he is advancing white supremacy. When the Obama administration put their consent decree together, it was August last year, you know, they didn't think they were going to win this election. Now that Sessions is in the House, oh no, it's not just a signal. He released that. They released that report yesterday to send a message. This public trial is going to be very different. And guess what? When the cops finally confess, as Brother Billy says, you know, I'm wondering why. Don't wonder why, brother. We need now some steel in our spines and stop acting like this is a surprise. We know what this is.
And Spencer, at the end of the day, when we see case after case, I mean, you look at the case of Flager in the Scott case in South Carolina.
Right.
He pleaded to civil rights charges, but again, he was acquitted in criminal.
Right. And so how are we going to move forward in terms of this stuff? How are we going to hold these folks accountable? As Greg gets to, this notion is, you know, black life. It has value and folks aren't recognizing it. Something else we've talked about before is these police unions, right? What can we do to basically hold the police unions accountable? I think they have a lot of influence here in terms of the process, and I think they are slowing things down.
Well, of course, because again, they are there to protect their folks, and that's where, Angela, when it comes to those contracts, those city contracts, why they matter, because that's where it was happening. We saw in San Antonio, where they wanted to put more accountability in the budget, they say, oh, fine, give us a massive pay raise if you want to make us accountable.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is it goes the gamut from A to Z, and we just got to keep picking and fighting and continuing to address these issues from a holistic standpoint.
Well, again, for the people who believe Black Lives Matter has no purpose, this is why.
That's right.
This is why, and we need other folks to step up because they've been too silent. And what's happened with these police officers, whether it's the cop in Utah who went after a white nurse,
that's right,
or whether what happened to Freddie Gray, when you have no accountability, these cops will continue doing what they're doing. Up next, Simon Cash with the Tom Joyner Morning Show. We'll talk about a man on death row in Georgia for 1990 murder of his sister-in-law. But what's up with this jury where one juror literally said he didn't think Black folks had souls? We'll talk with this man's attorney. Also, a state senator in Missouri could very well lose her job because she posted on Facebook she hoped for Trump's assassination. Should she quit? Or will she essentially be kicked out of the Missouri Senate by the Republican leadership there? All that next, News 19 TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Shut the hell up.
Okay. From Washington, D.C., Roland Martin. Good morning.
Tom, Sybil, Bill Bellamy, how are we doing?
Good. Good morning, my brother.
Mr. Martin.
All right, good chatting with all of you. And shout out to all the folks, all the celebrities and others who gave last night to the telethon put together by Houston rapper Bun B. Millions of dollars were raised for the folks affected by Hurricane Harvey, but also the folks affected by Hurricane Irma. And of course, Tom, a lot of our people in the Caribbean also are impacted in a significant way. U.S. Virgin Islands, of course, Puerto Rico, and also Haiti as well. And so let's not forget.
Oh, did you see Cuba?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
In Barbuda, 95% of all structures on the island destroyed as a result of the 185-mile-an-hour winds. And so it's going to be a massive rebuilding process. And so let's not forget them. Let's get to our story today, folks. In Georgia, a man jailed for 26 years for the brutal killing of his sister-in-law is hoping to have his case reopened, claiming racial bias affected his sentence. But if he fails, Keith Leroy Tharp will become the second person executed in that state this year on September 26. He shot his sister-in-law, rolled her into a ditch, then shot her again before kidnapping his wife and raping her by the side of the road. He was convicted of malice, murder, two counts of kidnapping with bodily injury, sentenced to death. But because of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling this year, his attorneys are hoping to reopen the case, saying a juror's racial bias influenced Tharp's sentence. We're now joined by his attorney, Brian Kammer, from Atlanta. Brian, is your client saying he did these things?
There's no dispute about his guilt in this in these crimes. This is about the death sentence.
The death sentence. And correct me if I'm wrong here, you had one of these, one of the jurors made a comment that essentially Black people did not have souls?
That's almost the least of what he said. He repeatedly, he boasted that he, you know, typically used racial epithets to describe African-American people, and that if people didn't like that, that was tough. He described the victim's family as, quote, nice Black folks, but Keith Tharp was, you know, described by a racial epithet, and that because of that, he deserved to be executed.
Now, these comments were made where? In the jury room or after the trial?
So they were made after the trial when our office investigated the case. Typically, we will interview jurors about their experiences on the, you know, deliberating as to the facts and so forth. And during one of those interviews, Mr. Gaddy expressed these very blatant, racially biased views, the most, you know, very explicitly, and was willing to sign an affidavit attesting to those. He even made corrections on the affidavit, which is a sworn statement, which were very explicit about his views and his use of racial epithets to describe African-American people and Mr. Tharp in particular. While the state came back at him and got, you know, an additional affidavit and there was testimony in court, he never, you know, came back off of his views. And the judge in our, this was a proceeding called habeas corpus, which is a common proceeding in capital cases. The judge refused to look at the evidence because of a state law that says juror testimony that impeaches the verdict is inadmissible. So what we're doing is we're trying to use this recent U.S. Supreme Court case, which says those kinds of laws cannot prohibit courts from considering this kind of invidious racism on the part of jurors.
Brian, I know somebody listening right now, they're saying, I don't have any sympathy for this guy. He is a flat-out killer.
Okay, and, my hand's up.
And say deserve to die. But the issue here, Brian, is that there are other cases where the racial bias of jurors comes into play. And if I'm correct, Georgia also, didn't they also have a case that went to the Supreme Court where the prosecutors were systematically removing black jurors from death penalty cases to ensure they would get convictions?
That's exactly right. In fact, the prosecutor you're talking about is the same prosecutor who prosecuted Mr. Tharp, Joe Briley, a notorious prosecutor in the Okmulgee Judicial Circuit here in Georgia, who was found by the Supreme Court to have essentially systematically attempted to underrepresent African-American people, women, on juries without making it look like they were doing that. He authored a memo to the jury commissioners telling them how to do it without getting caught. And, you know, he's notorious. He used 90% of his what they call peremptory jury strikes, where you get to strike a juror for no reason. He used those strikes to get rid of African-American jurors in the jury pools. In the county where Mr. Tharp was convicted, in fact, he struck five of eight African-American, eight African-American jurors in the jury pool in Mr. Tharp's case.
So Brian, the issue here is that if there were black jurors on this trial, on this jury, that he conceivably still would have gotten the death penalty. But is your argument
right,
that we can't have racial bias anywhere in the criminal justice system, whether the person admits to the crime or not?
That's exactly right. And these cases that we're talking about from the Supreme Court, they dealt with, you know, murders. And all murders have very painful facts and involve people who did terrible things. But we can't have these cases being decided in an environment where there's racial discrimination. In this case, it's explicit. One of the jurors held the most, you know, awful kinds of beliefs that you can imagine about African-American people. It wasn't the facts that, were really on his mind as much as the fact that Mr. Tharp was an African-American person. That was the deciding factor for this guy.
And Tom, are there not other cases for you to use?
Use all these man hours for somebody who is maybe innocent?
We represent all, we provide representation for just about all of the cases in Georgia. So we don't pick and choose. We work with everybody, and we do I believe, very high quality work for all of our
no
clients.
No doubt.
But Tom and Sybil, let me say this. On the Supreme Court, etched in stone, equal justice under law. It does not matter if we think they're innocent or guilty. The point is equal justice under law, because today it could be Tharp who clearly did it. Tomorrow could be somebody who didn't do it, and you still have racial bias on that jury. That's
just the
issue.
Saying, let's concentrate on the ones who didn't do it.
No, but the reason the Supreme Court ruled is because it was in a case where the person was guilty, and they said you can't use racial bias. So we can't just say only those who are innocent. That's why the Supreme Court ruled, as Brian said.
And you can't help everyone.
You can't help everyone, but equal justice under law.
We try.
And you're certainly making a statement here.
Yeah. I guess. All right. Good job.
Thanks a bunch, folks. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks, Brian. Coming up next, a Missouri state senator is under fire after posting a comment on her personal Facebook page that she hoped President Trump is assassinated. Many are calling for her to resign from office. She has refused to do so. Now the Missouri legislature could very well boot her out of office. We'll discuss that next. Also, was it an accident or foul play? A Chicago family wants to know how their loved one, a 19-year-old black woman, ended up dead inside a hotel freezer. An autopsy report expected today could shed new revelations on that death. All that next, News 1 Now on TV One.
Don't leave.
My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News 1 Now starts next.
Are you serious? Don't you just love it when there's video?
News 1 Now continues on TV One.
All right, folks, Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal could very well lose her job if she does not resign by today. She posted a comment a few weeks ago on her personal Facebook page that she hoped President Donald Trump is assassinated. The comment was posted after Trump's many-sided statement regarding the violence at the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. First, she refused to apologize. Then, after much scrutiny and pressure, including from the governor and others, she decided to make a public apology.
I want to make this apology to our president and his family. President Trump, I apologize to you and your family. I also apologize to all of the people in Missouri. And I also apologize to my colleagues in the Missouri legislature for the mistake that I made. And I made a mistake, and I'm owning up to it. And I am not ever going to make a mistake like that again. And I have learned my lesson. My judge and my jury is my Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, now Republicans and Democrats in the Missouri legislature are calling on her to resign from office. Governor Eric Greitens posted this on Twitter. If she will not resign, the Senate can vote to remove her. I believe they should. Senator Chappelle Nadal maintains that she wrote the post because of her frustration with the situation and doesn't wish any harm towards President Trump. Let's go to our panel with this. Someone started this way. Flip the script. White state senator from Missouri posts on Facebook that President Obama should be assassinated. Black folks would be saying that person needs to resign. Should she resign?
Sliding scale. No, she shouldn't resign. There's a First Amendment in the United States. But again, it's different rules for black people. This guy, Warren Love, in the Missouri, on the House side, he says that they should hang the people who are throwing paint on these Confederate monuments. And they said, well, then both of them should apply, equal rules should apply to both of them. The guy on the Senate side says, I want to apply equal rules. Maria Chappelle made a mistake, but look at this. She's on television apologizing, calling to Jesus, because as a black woman, she's got a sliding scale. Of course she can't. Meanwhile, the president of the United States is out there talking about give rough rides to prisoners, beat them up, talking about protesters should be beat up. The attorney general of the United States is saying protect the police, whatever they're doing, they need to be able to do. There's no double, there's a triple, quadruple standard here in America. No, she should not resign.
I mean, look, I think all of our elected leaders have got to be more accountable for what they do and what they say. They're in leadership positions. The people of this country are looking to them and electing them into those positions because they expect for them to operate in a certain way. And so I think that across the board, our leaders have got to act more responsible, and they owe it to the public. They owe it to the citizens of the United States.
So yes or no, should she resign?
I think she should, and I think every leader who is making a statement to that, those kind of egregious statements, should also.
Spencer?
You know, number one, what she said was wrong, right? That doesn't have a place in our political dialogue. Number two, this is really politics, right? I mean, Democrats and Republicans in Missouri are doing what's in their political interest in terms of calling for her to resign, and I think she has apologized.
No, remember, right. Remember, she was adamant she was not going to apologize.
Right.
Right.
Then when there was the pressure.
Right.
Then there was a statement. Then she apologized.
Okay.
It's not like, okay, posted it, deleted it, immediately apologized, show remorse, show defiance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then the pressure, then the apology.
Right.
Let me just be clear. I do not think black people will be this forgiving if the script was flipped. The problem here.
Trump does say stuff like this.
No,
there's no apology.
Right. And here's the piece. When you are an elected official,
right,
and when you are calling for the assassination of the president of the United States, I don't care. I don't care if it's Trump. I don't care if it's anybody else. That is extremely problematic.
Absolutely.
And it simply cannot be excused. And now, again, she has to decide by today. She is going to be thrown out. And according to their law, of course it's political pressure.
Right.
And they took out all the committees.
Right.
Eight committees she's been taken out by the Democrats. Right. I mean, here's the fundamental question is this. Can even elected officials have the protections of the Constitution? As we talked about in that death penalty case, that guy was a bad case, but then there is the law.
Right.
The law is harsh, but it's the law. Do we allow politics to trump the Constitution of the United States?
This isn't a constitutional question, right? This is really
a
political question. Well, First Amendment, she can say whatever she wants. She's not entitled to a seat in the Senate.
You're right about the First Amendment. But as we all know, you have the First Amendment rights, but there are also consequences to what you say.
Sure.
And in this case, likely will be kicked out and could very well lose her pension. Now, if the law allows for her to run again, I wouldn't be surprised if the voters reelect her.
Sure.
But this is, we talked about accountability earlier. Right. This is also what happens when you are a public official,
sure,
when you make those kinds of statements. That is when you talk about the assault call, when you post
wrong.
It, I don't care how frustrated and pissed off you are with Donald Trump or Sessions or anybody else. I don't care how pissed off a Tea Party was with President Obama. That goes far than anything else. She crossed a line and will likely pay this price. And that's the result of crossing that line.
Right. But the question is, should she pay the price? That's really the question. I mean,
it's a question of should. She will.
Now, that's
she
true.
Will.
In terms of policy.
I don't care. You're not going to find a Republican or Democrat who's going to say, no. Calling for the assassination of a president, even if it's a quick post on a Facebook page, as an elected official, you are expected to know better and act appropriately.
Unless you are white.
And guess what? And if you're white, we're going to say the exact same thing.
That's true.
Again, standard is a standard.
It's the moral case, no question.
Let's talk about Chicago when we come back, folks. The mother of a Chicago teen found dead inside a deep freezer has more questions than answers. We'll talk with a reporter there in Chicago to find out what's going on with this case. Plus, this weekend on TV One, a new movie out with Boris Kodjoe and Nicole Ari Parker. The movie's called Downsize. We'll talk about that movie with them when we come back.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
The police department couldn't even help us. After they found my baby dead, they couldn't even help us. The bastards!
It's the mother of a teenage girl found dead in a hotel deep freezer just outside of Chicago. She is demanding answers. The body of 19-year-old Kanika Jenkins was discovered Saturday afternoon inside the kitchen walk-in freezer at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Rosemont, Illinois. Her body was found by hotel staff. Jenkins was at the hotel the night before celebrating a birthday party with friends. They admit they were drinking and using drugs. Still, what happens next is a mystery. Around 4:30 a.m., friends say they found her cell phone and truck keys, but no Kanika. Right now, authorities do not suspect foul play and are waiting for a toxicology report. I don't understand how you don't expect foul play when you ended up in a freezer. They're also reviewing a Facebook video posted by one of her friends at the party. They believe she may have been drinking, wandered off, and ended up in the deep freezer. Her mother is not convinced.
I believe that someone in this hotel killed my child. It's something that no one could ever imagine.
Darlene is a reporter with Fox 32, has been following the case. Darlene, glad to have you on the show. So, Darlene Hill, sorry about that. So, okay, this freezer, is it a walk-in freezer? Is it one that there are different types of freezers? One where you have to actually have to open a door and place something in versus a walk-in. Explain that.
What we're hearing about this freezer, it's a commercial size, industrial size freezer that's in a very isolated area of the kitchen there at the hotel. So not a lot of details on that. Rosemont police are being tight-lipped, as you said, with a lot of the details on this investigation. There's a lot of information, as you said, Roland Martin, out there on social media, on Facebook, on Instagram. A lot of facts, quote-unquote facts out there, but Rosemont police are being tight-lipped. I can tell you right now that Fox 32 Chicago has learned exclusively that Rosemont police will be sitting down with the mother of Kanika Jenkins this morning. Teresa Martin, you heard her, please, asking for more answers than questions. She wants more answers than questions right now, not getting them. They are going to spend some time with her this morning reviewing the tapes. Retakes there at that Crown Plaza Hotel outside of Chicago. It was actually out by O'Hare Airport, which is about 35 minutes northwest of the downtown area. Her body was found out there. The mother will be spending some time out there trying to figure out what happened, how her baby's body ended up in that freezer, a large freezer. The mother says her daughter was probably 110, 120 pounds, as big as this industrial-sized freezer was. There's no way this young lady could open the door. So as you said, there's no way you could end up drunk, end up high, whatever, since so many people admitted to using drugs and alcohol that night. How she herself ended up in that freezer, an area in the hotel where it's only accessible to employees. That's the key right there.
So, and that's what really jumps out in terms of if you had a party. Look, man, I've been to many hotels. Finding your way into a kitchen, which requires, going through back doors and then a deep freezer. I mean, the logic is there. I would also assume this hotel has cameras all around the hotel to be able to track movements.
Right, and that's what they're hoping. The mother is hoping that by looking at the surveillance video, she's been asking about this video. Let me see the tapes there at the hotel. Mm-hmm. She's been asking for that since Saturday morning when she discovered her daughter did not come home, her daughter was not answering her calls, and her daughter had her vehicle. She needed her vehicle, and she said, hey, something's gone wrong. This is not the actions of Kanika Jenkins, not my child. So this mother is going to be able to hopefully see where she walked in the hotel, what room she was in the hotel, and how much time she spent in those hotels with a number of her friends. That's the thing a lot of people are talking about here in Chicago. It's not that Rosemont police are not being so quick with the answers, that they're conducting, they say, a thorough investigation. They're using social media as part of this investigation. A major part of the investigation going on right now is what posts people are putting out there on social media. The apologies out there. One friend even posted something like, Kanika, I wish I had had your back that night. So somebody knows something, and I'm mad, more disturbed with the friends in that room, not so much with the police conducting their investigation, but the friends in that room, they know something, they saw something, and they're just trying to act like nothing has happened. That's somebody's child, and this mother is demanding answers, and she deserves those answers.
Darlene Hill, we appreciate it, thanks a lot. I want to quickly go to our panel here. What jumps out at me is a lot of people have been blasting the police. I am with them not releasing information. This is an investigation.
Right.
You need to investigate, and you can't release information because you're questioning witnesses.
Right.
That's right. It's right. I mean, you know, what struck me was the family went out there knocking on doors. The hotel people say, hold on, we can't do that. It is all unfolding. And as we heard from Anchor Hill there, you know, the young people clearly know something. And the police have to really seal this and walk through it.
About 30 seconds. Go ahead.
We got to investigate. We can't just say, oh, it's a young girl, she was drunk or she was on drugs, therefore it's not a problem. Hey, we got to investigate. We got to investigate. Her life has man.
And Angela, value. To our point, we're talking about the death penalty case, whether we're talking about the state senator in Missouri. It does not matter. That is, if you have a standard, you investigate. You also don't want any racial bias in juries as well. Again, that's what people are saying, period.
Right, right. And my heart goes out to this family during this time of investigation.
Yeah, whatever happens, right. It's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy.
That's right. All right, folks, hold tight. We come back. We're going to talk here from Boris Kodjoe and Nicole Ari Parker, starring in a new film right here on TV One called Downsize. What happens when your marriage runs into a little trouble? That's next News One Now, TV One.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
What are you forced into marriage due to a teen pregnancy, and then you decide to go your own separate ways 25 years later as the premise of a new TV One movie, Downsize, starring Boris Kodjoe and Nicole Ari Parker. I talked with him at the American Black Film Festival about the movie.
We're here at ABFF with the movie Downsize for TV One. We are really excited to be here. We love the festival and we love this film.
Y'all got the whole crew here.
Yes, so y'all brought the kids.
So it's like a whole crew thing because so you were saying that what? So y'all kids, Sally and Dondre's kids,
yep.
Chris Spencer and his
Vanessa. Yeah.
So
yes.
Y'all kids like, look, we good. Y'all go along. Go along.
I picked them up last night around midnight. They didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
You know, go.
Yeah.
No, we don't want to go. So
they
having a good time.
So much fun. The beach, the pool.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's always a good thing when there's something else for you. Like, okay, we can be grown.
Yes.
So y'all got your own people y'all can hang out with. Mm-hmm. We got our people we can hang
exactly.
out with.
Exactly.
And then everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to work your way there because now they're old enough so they can hang out with their friends. But
yes.
You know, 5 years ago,
with
they
supervision.
Were...
supervision. Mean, we didn't just drop them off with some Cheerios and be like...
Here's the room key.
You need me. No.
Call 911 if something happens.
Well, that's always a good thing when kids get older because you be like, okay, y'all got this.
Mm-hmm.
I could think back to the number of times my parents left. It was me, my brother, my sister, my two young sisters.
No, back in the day.
And
no.
We were straight up, I mean, I'm talking about, 12, 13, 14.
No seatbelts. Everybody smoked.
No, it was very simple.
You had your own house key.
Lock the damn door. Don't unlock the door. It was it. I mean, those were the rules.
Yeah.
And you knew, don't go near that door.
Yeah.
Don't peep out the window.
Yeah. That's funny.
That was always a deal.
Oh, my gosh. Dinner's on the stove,
huh?
Right?
Oh, no, no. Yeah. No, no, no. We raised a cook.
Oh, raised a cook, yes.
Oh, no. We had to cook.
Yep.
Same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Sophie can cook.
Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Sophie can cook,
I had to cook, too.
Yeah, no, all that stuff, waiting on them to cook, no. We were baking at 7, cooking at 8.
There you go.
Because my mom had a cake company, so she baked.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was cool. So by the time
we were
12, we're like, all right, we straight. It's like, y'all go ahead. Plus, the beauty of cooking is you can eat what you want to eat. So when you later get married, you ain't got to lie when it ain't good. It's like, and I'm going to go ahead.
I got this, baby.
I got
it. Sit down.
I'm going to go ahead and cook.
Yep.
Why do you keep saying that?
Because it's true.
What's interesting to me about marriage and family and all of that is that I don't care who you are, I don't care what level you're on, there are basic things people go through.
It's all the same.
Whether it's children, whether it's
totally.
Things like cooking, whether it's whatever, that, whether we want to own up to it or not, causes friction. Sometimes there's small friction, whether or not, did you really wash my clothes on hot? When that tag says warm. Yeah, I had to deal with that. Cause you know, when the pants were shrunken, I'm like, okay, but that tag said warm. I don't read tags, but that's why there's a tag.
In three languages.
Right. So it's like, I got this. So, but then there are other moments when things get far more serious
mm-hmm.
that a lot of people don't want to deal with.
Well, I think that's the key right there, because a lot of people when they get married, they don't use challenges and obstacles as an opportunity to grow. They use it as an excuse to walk out the door.
Yep.
And I think that, and that's what the movie talks about. The movie talks about a couple committing to being together for the next 25 years. They were teenage parents. And then after 25 years, they decide, look, are we going to keep this going? Or are we going to go separate ways? And for us, personally, I think it was always a big deal that we wanted to give each other the opportunity to grow through adversity and through challenges.
Yes.
And because, you know, when you get together, you're two individuals.
Yep.
From two different places.
It's
two different backgrounds.
225 pounds of challenge.
And what I tell people,
right.
It's
225.
Not,
why you gotta put out the weight? Wow, she's got.
Right,
she's going
that,
in.
That was some shade. That was.
225 pounds of solid German, high performance. vehicle is what I'm talking about.
Oh, I thought she, see, I would take another way. I was like, 225, you're being generous. I would have put it back on her.
Oh. he wants to,
if you're going to throw the shade, you're like, okay. Baby, you shouldn't talk about stuff like that.
Why are you so eager to throw everything away?
It's important that you realize that, you know, you're individuals and you're going to remain that. Yes, you work together. Yes, you create synergies. But a lot of people say, we're going to become one. No, you're not. You're not going to become one. You're still going to be you, and I'm still going to be me.
Well, and what I say is, it's not 50-50. It's not... No, you're 100-100.
100-100.
I mean, so it's not... No,
absolutely.
Because it's not. It's not. Because
absolutely.
If you say it's 50-50, that means that you're half of a person.
Yeah.
But you're not.
Mm-hmm.
You're
I
a whole
like
person.
Absolutely.
And you bring all that comes to bear with it.
Well, after 12 years of marriage, I had to come face-to-face with a lot of things I brought to the relationship,
yes.
Which is... You get on my nerves up to a certain point. I am the rollout modern girl. You know, I can do this. Like, so when we were boyfriend and girlfriend, I was always like, and, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't have that skill for that, you know, level of respecting where we are.
Mm-hmm.
I always had that option. And then there's something that happens, A, when you get married, and then when you have children. That option just flew out the door.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't just get mad, slam the door, all those things. And so I was still working with, we are 100 together. Sometimes I'm 70 and you're 30, 60, 40. Sometimes in a good relationship, you think 50-50. But this is deep, that part of the next journey is making sure I'm 100.
That comes first.
And that he's 100, and then we work together.
You two will finish school and establish yourselves. Your father and I will help raise the baby.
So when I think about this movie, and we all know historically, people we know and family members, individuals who have had kids at 17, 18, they got married so young that they never ever knew who they were.
That's
and
a
so,
very real
and
thing.
And then they go down that road, because as you said also earlier, when you have kids, one of the big, and again, my wife and I do not have kids, but we raised six of my nieces. And one of the things that I have witnessed with brothers and sisters and other people is that they never make the point when they say, oh, hold up, we were here before they were here.
Oh, we say that all the time.
Yeah. And people go, oh my God, you're pushing your kids' place? Like,
no. It's not the same
but
thing.
But if this ain't tight.
That won't be tight.
That won't
work out. We remind each other a lot of that very thing. Remember, we were here first? Because we want to make sure that this is strong.
That's right.
Because everything else falls into place after that.
Yeah.
So we're very much aware of that.
It's not easy, though, in real time. It's not.
I mean,
there's basketball games and
ballet recitals and homework. And
projects and travel and work.
Okay, so it's interesting. So if I take the title of this movie, Downsized.
Yes.
Have you ever said to the kids, y'all doing too much? Because what happens is, you take kids and it's school, it's ballet, it's basketball, it's all this sort of stuff, and then next thing you know, you're on the treadmill and you're just constantly being scheduled, versus you say, no. You need to pick one thing you're gonna do in terms of pullback.
We do that with each other.
Yeah.
Like, you need to. There's no more airplanes in the next 2 weeks of your life. 3 weeks of your life. There was a point, Roland, just a month ago, he had been to 4 different countries in 2 weeks. Countries. And he got home and he wasn't himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so and he's doing it for work, for his family. And so I said, we're good. Like, it's okay. You know, delegate some of that responsibility out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take care of each other that way.
Part 2 of our interview tomorrow right here on News 1 Now. When we come back, we'll talk about Donald Trump's sham voter fraud commission. It's a fraud. Back on News 1 Now, TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, time for our second hour of News One Now. We come back, we'll talk Florida. The cleanup continues in the Southeast U.S., plus in the U.S. Virgin Islands and other parts of the Caribbean. Also, we'll talk Donald Trump's Voter Integrity Commission, which is really a fraudulent commission. We'll chat with Kristen Clark of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Also, a conversation with Michael Bulwer Moore, President and CEO of the International African American Museum, set for South Carolina. And Congress goes on the record against racist violence. Will Trump actually sign this? We shall see. Plus, Jemele Hill stirs up a little stuff on Twitter. We'll break it down. News 1 Now, TV 1. Sixteen folks who have died have been tied to Irma's devastation all across the southeast part of the United States. The cleanup continues as people are still affected. Massive power outages. Some 5 million folks have been impacted. Sarah Rosario is an NBC reporter from Miami who joins us with the latest.
Good morning to you, Roland. Here in Miami, the flooding that we saw during the height of the storm has since... But as you can see behind me, there's a couple trees down. Cleanup is underway here. That's what we're seeing across this city. But in the Florida Keys, that's where there is a dire need. People anxious to return to their homes are getting there, and they're finding they don't have any homes to return to. You may remember Hurricane Irma slammed through that area as a Category 4 storm, leaving widespread destruction, homes ripped off their foundations, roads washed away, neighborhoods reduced to rubble. And now the cleanup efforts are underway. What was once a tropical island now looks like a war zone. The Navy medical responders have come into town. They're going to be there for the next couple of days for quite some time, trying to help these people, giving them supplies that they need, things like food, water. We have the USS Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. It's a warship now on a mission of mercy. It's able to provide 100,000 gallons of water to the Keys in just one day. Search and rescue teams are also on the ground in the Keys trying to find people who are unaccounted for or anybody who may be stranded. Outside of the Keys, across the state, we're still feeling the effects of Irma. We've got flooding in some of the streets in South Carolina and also in Jacksonville, where historic floods there not expected to recede for at least another week. The good news out of all of this is that power is expected to be restored to Florida as early as this weekend. Some other people along the west coast of Florida may have to wait about 10 days. Reporting live in Miami, Sarah Rosario. Roland, back to you.
All right, Sarah, thanks a bunch. Let's now talk about voter suppression. Well, Donald Trump is calling this Election Integrity Commission. Really, it's about voter suppression. They hit the road going to New Hampshire. The panel held a public meeting there questioning the Granite State's same-day voter registration and raising concerns about the 6,500 people who voted in the state during the 2016 presidential election, even though they had out-of-state IDs. Well, let's just say they got smacked upside the head by folks in New Hampshire, officials there who said, you do know that's allowed. People can actually do that. But that was not enough for Commission Vice Chair Kris Kobach, who is known to lie about voter fraud.
And until you make the next cut to determine how many are non-domiciled and then the final cut to actually determine how they voted, we will never know the answer regarding the legitimacy of that particular election.
I mean, literally, Republicans in New Hampshire were telling him he's out of his mind when it comes to allegations of voter fraud. Let's break this thing down here with Kristen Clark, Executive Director and President, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Kristen, what is amazing here is that here's a dude from Kansas who has been sanctioned for BS, who's lied to folks testifying, who has made allegations of voter fraud and was proven to be a lie. And now he's trying to tell New Hampshire about their state when they say, we got this.
One of the most powerful moments during the hearing yesterday was when the Secretary of State discredited Kobach's statements and called them reckless.
The Secretary of State, who is responsible for voting in New Hampshire.
That's right. And he said, how dare you cast doubt on elections that I conduct and carry out in this state. We know that Kobach timed placement of a column in Breitbart, a vehicle that has been described by Steve Bannon as a platform for the alt-right. He planted this story about fraudulent voting in New Hampshire. And what he's really doing is placing a target on the backs of students. We know that there are countless numbers of students in New Hampshire who may have an out-of-state driver's license because they don't drive during their time attending college in that state, but they have a right under that state's law to register and exercise the right to vote.
So stop right there. So for folks to understand why this matters, I'm going to go back to Texas. Waller County, where Prairie View A&M is located, they have been fighting, PV students have been fighting white elected officials in Waller County for at least two decades because they know that if Prairie View students are registered to vote in Waller County, they could flip any election. And so they fought to keep them from using their IDs to actually vote. There have been legal battles going on. And so what Kobach is trying to do, we've seen this in other states as well, they want to target young voters who they believe have a propensity to vote for Democrats to keep them from voting in those places, knowing full well if you have a university that has 6, 8, 10, 20,000 students, how they're going to vote. In North Carolina, they pulled an early voting location off of the college campus. In Wisconsin, the clerk there in one of the towns in Wisconsin said she was not going to put an early voting location on the college campus because too many of those students vote Democrat.
Right. It's not just students, though, right? Throughout time, we've seen schemes that have targeted African Americans and Latinos and the elderly. At the end of the day, the Election Integrity Commission exists for one sole purpose. They're staging these meetings across the country to lay the groundwork for a national push around laws that will make it harder for vulnerable communities to vote.
In fact, these folks yesterday even talked about having a background check
at
the polls.
It was one of the most offensive moments of the hearing. John Lott, who is known to be a Second Amendment zealot, somehow thought that it would be interesting to talk about using background checks that we impose on gun owners, people who are seeking to buy guns, that we use those kinds of background checks on voters. It's clear that this commission wants to intimidate voters and chill the electorate. We are continuing to litigate against the commission because they are failing to be transparent. We learned in the course of our litigation that commission members are using private email addresses to carry out and conduct commission business. Our end goal at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law is to shut down this commission. We think it's an unprecedented vehicle. It's a threat to democracy with the sole goal of pushing voter suppression efforts across the country. But let me make one final point. The makeup of speakers who spoke during the day was deeply troubling. There were three panels, a total of 12 speakers. Every single one of them was a white male. No race, no gender, no ideological diversity whatsoever. This is Kobach racing forward and really just building a platform to push voter suppression at the end of the day.
Spencer Overton, president, Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, also author of the book Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. Spencer, that's exactly what this is. This is not even, they're not even trying to dress it up.
Yeah, it's certainly a witch hunt. And just to kind of step back, you remember Republicans lost by 1,000 votes in terms of the U.S. Senate race, right? And so here, Kobach has found 5,000 votes where people registered with these out-of-state IDs. And again, many of these could be college students, et cetera. But before any real investigation is done, Kobach says it's likely that there is fraud. I mean, that is just so political and irresponsible. And again, to do that when you have the Secretary of State from New Hampshire, who's there. But it really makes me wonder, Was this a setup all along? Is this the reason they put the Secretary of State of New Hampshire on this commission so they could get this data and try to make this claim?
Right, right. And, you know, we have to view this in the context of what's happening on a larger scale. All of this is unfolding at a time when we're seeing the Justice Department scale back civil rights enforcement. We haven't seen this Justice Department mount a single case under the Voting Rights Act in 2017. In fact, we see them reversing course,
right,
and taking positions that are fully opposite to the stance they've taken for years. It's clear that this is an administration that is mounting an assault in the most vicious way on voting rights, and this commission is part and parcel of that broader agenda.
Angela, look, you're Republican, and this is clear. They are trying to shave off 3,000, 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 in each of these states, knowing full well that can affect elections. We saw in North Carolina where they actually sent emails specifically asking for when did black people vote. And when they saw that upwards of 80 to 90% of black people voted in the first week of early voting, they slashed early voting sites all across North Carolina in the first 2 weeks to keep black folks from voting. This is an approved tactic of the Republican Party.
Well, we need this commission to broaden its purpose. I mean,
why do we need the commission?
Well,
it's a fraudulent commission.
Well, if we're going to have the commission needs to also be investigating suppression. I mean, when we look at our most powerful right, one of our most powerful rights is to vote. And if you're only looking at fraud and not looking at suppression,
but the compensation,
you're creating
is problematic.
Complete.
I mean, the chairs, you don't have a bipartisan group.
And in fact, the Heritage Foundation,
right,
sent a letter,
that's right,
to them saying, do not put any moderate Republicans or Democrats on the committee.
That's right.
So the committee can't look at voter suppression because it's not designed for that. It is designed to actually enact voter suppression.
Well, I think Kristen made the point, the three words, lay the foundation. We talk about the right to vote. I don't know that there is a right to vote in the federal constitution.
No, there is no right to vote.
Exactly.
In fact, in Bush v. Gore, it was Antonin Scalia who put in this ruling that there is no affirmative right to vote in the United States Constitution, because actually before, legislatures could actually decide who the elected officials are. There is
That's
no
right.
affirmative right to vote.
Right.
The only thing that's in the Constitution is that black folks and women cannot be denied the right to vote.
That's exactly
what
right.
So what they really say is white folks do not have any protection, legal protections in the Constitution.
That's right.
Is really black folks and women who can't be denied.
That's exactly right. And I'm glad you mentioned Scalia as well, because of course we saw a fifth vote for what happened in Texas. They're going to allow those gerrymandered districts to stand, and that fifth vote was the one that Trump put on Justice Gorsuch McConnell. But at the end of the day, they're laying the foundation for a longer game plan. They're trying to constrict the right to vote. Finally, that commission, that under Obama, where they talking about expanding the vote, they just had a commission to deal with this question of vote, and many states followed those recommendations. Keep fighting this. This thing has to be disbanded.
And Christian, this is, I mean, again, people might be saying, hey, okay, you know, why are you making a focus of this? One of the reasons I got NABJ's Journalist of the Year in 2013 was because of our intense coverage on voter suppression. Mm-hmm. This has been the game plan.
Absolutely.
For the last, not 20 years. This has been the game plan since the Voting Rights Act was passed.
That's right.
In 1965.
Absolutely.
And it was the election of President Obama where all of a sudden, you saw it in 2010 where they said, oh, all of a sudden, voter ID, all these different legal, and what they've done is they've studied the law to say, okay, how can we legally limit voting so we don't run afoul? Then you throw in the Supreme Court decision about the Voting Rights Act with preclearance. That basically gave them the superhighway to be able to go down this path.
That's right. I mean, we're past the era of literacy tests and poll taxes. These are people who support voter suppression resorting to, quote, more sophisticated tactics to peel people off at the margins. Our elections in this country are hotly contested.
Right.
Outcomes are very close. You put a photo ID law in place in Texas and you can peel off 2% here. Mm. You put a burdensome proof of citizenship requirement in place in Kansas and you can peel off 3% there. It's part of a pattern we have seen throughout history of disenfranchising minority groups. It's one of the reasons why voting rights and defending access to the ballot box is so central to the work that we do at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. The attacks that we are seeing now are unprecedented, and I encourage people to join our fight, learn more about our work and how they can support our fight by visiting our website at www.lawyerscommittee.org.
Okay, don't just visit the site, also contribute.
Yes, yes.
Contribute, because you need money to fight, because you got to be, you're fighting this in courts.
We do, and the assaults that we face now are just unprecedented in scope, so we need all the support that we can get to mount a fight against this administration.
Kristen Clark, thanks so much. We appreciate it. When we come back, we'll talk about the International African American Museum being planned in Charleston, South Carolina. We'll show you details of that museum with its CEO. Also on the show, ESPN's Jemele Hill got folks all ticked off when she called Donald Trump a white supremacist. We'll tell you about that. Plus, we'll hear from Boris Kodjo and Nicole Ari Parker, starring in a new TV One film, Downsize, airing this weekend. It is 16 after the hour. News 1 Now on TV One.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
A year ago, the National Museum of African American History and Culture opened in Washington, D.C. There are any number of black museums all across the country focused on our history. Here on this show, we've actually broadcast live from places like the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. Also, we've been, of course, at the Eddie Robinson Museum there in Grambling and so many others. And as a new museum being planned to open in Charleston, South Carolina, the International African American Museum. Recently, I talked with the president and CEO, Michael Bulwer Moore, about the museum, and our conversation began as he explains the importance of this new museum and why it is located in Charleston.
Our museum is in Charleston, which many don't know was really the genesis story of African American history. We're building a museum on the spot where almost half of all the enslaved Africans who came to America disembarked, took their first steps. And so there's a real sacredness to the space that we are building this museum on. From an international standpoint, we want to talk about the international slave trade, about the fact of boats and the slave ships coming from England and being financed and getting folks from Africa, bringing them to the Caribbean, bringing them to America. We're going to talk about the diaspora. A good chunk of folks left here in revolutionary times, left Charleston, went to Nova Scotia, went to Canada, went back to the Caribbean, went back to Africa. So we're going to talk a lot about that. That's one element that makes this museum different. But then there are some others as well.
So how much will this museum cost?
It's a $75 million project.
And who's funding it?
It's a great question. It's funded a third, $25 million, by the city and the county, Charleston City and the county. We've asked the state of South Carolina for $25 million, and then there's $25 million in private fundraising that we're out in the middle of fundraising now.
And what's been the reaction so far from the state?
We've gotten $14 million of the $25 million, and we're in the process of completing the private fundraising before going back to the state for the remaining $11 million.
And obviously I've talked to folks with different museums all around the country, African American museums, and sustainability is one of those critical issues. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to this one, give us a sense of its scope, its size, how large will it be, the complex, is, multiple levels. Give us that perspective.
Yeah, it's one story lifted 14 feet off the ground, in part in deference to the sacredness of the site and of what happened there. It's longer than a football field. It's long and narrow, 40,000 square feet. So it's not enormously large, but it's enough for us to tell the story, to pique the interest of people, and then to send them to other various museums around. We want to send them to Penn Center down in St. Helena. We want to send them to Georgetown, to the Rice Fields. We want to really help to tell the story, focusing on the role that Charleston and the Lowcountry played, because it really is such a fundamental role, particularly in colonial America. And we hope to break ground beginning of 2018, and it'll take a couple of years to build and to before we can open.
When was this first conceived?
Actually, it's been going for about 15 years. The former mayor, Joe Riley, conceived of it, talked about it in the State of the City address back in 2000. And it's taken time to sort of build a political case for it and to certainly raise money. And over the last 4 or 5 years, it's really gained momentum, and we are really close now.
And obviously, for you, it's a lot personal because of your historical ties.
Yeah, it really is personal. My great-great-grandfather, well, even before that, my great-great-great-grandmother actually landed on the site. It's the former Gadsden's Wharf. It was the longest, the largest wharf in the colonies, and it was really, again, the epicenter of the transatlantic slave trade in terms of North America. It's where almost half of all the enslaved Africans arrived. So that's the start of it, and then her grandson, Robert Smalls, commandeered a Confederate boat. He worked in Charleston and had this vision to be free.
Worked as a slave or was free man?
He was enslaved. No, he was enslaved. Yeah, he worked on a boat, and that once the Civil War broke out was sort of commandeered by the Confederacy into service of the Confederate Army. And he knew just outside the mouth of the Charleston Harbor was a federal blockade, a Union blockade, and that if he could get there, he would be free. And so concocted this plan, got his wife, the crew and their families, and one night when the Confederate crew left, went into town, he took off and made his way to freedom.
And later made his way to D.C.
He did. He first started off, as many politicians do, and joined or was elected to the school board down in Beaufort, South Carolina, but then was elected to the legislature, to the House, and to the Senate. One of the things that he did of note in the South Carolina legislature is he authored legislation to create the first free, compulsory statewide school system, actually in the country. So there were public schools, of course, but this was the first time that a state enacted a free public school system for all, and was elected to Congress after that.
And that's one of the things that I think I often talk about when I'm talking about school choice around this country, and people don't understand the role that African Americans made in terms of the South, in terms of public education. James D. Anderson breaks it down, The Education of Blacks in the South, 1860 to 1935, where he lays out in that particular book that role. And so, you know, people are running around talking about public education. Again, taxpayer-financed public education, Black folks made that possible.
Yes, sir. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think for him, it really pained him that he could not read and write as an enslaved person. One of the first things he did, he got a reward for delivering the boat, which was full of munitions and guns and the like, to the Union. He got a reward. The first thing he did was he hired tutors. At 5 o'clock in the morning, he had one session, and then later in the evening, and he taught himself to learn to read and write, and then he fought to extend that right to all.
Again, you spoke of $25 million from the city and county. You've gotten $14 to $25 million from the state. How much has been privately raised?
We're more than halfway there, so we've raised $13 million or so. We've got a lot of really great quality asks out there, and we're working hard to complete that fundraising.
All right, effort. So what's the website that folks want to give?
IAAMuseum.org, www.IAAMuseum.org.
Okay, well, certainly appreciate it. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. ESPN's Jemele Hill calls Donald Trump a white supremacist. ESPN apologizes for her comment, but does she apologize? We'll talk about that next. Also, Nicole Ari Parker, Boris Kodjo, starring a new TV One film, Downsize. We'll show you what they had to say about that film. And it's Wednesday. Our comedians are here for Wild Not Wednesday. Got to have a little fun to end the show. We'll be back. News 1-9 TV One.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Congress has approved a resolution condemning white supremacists and other hate groups. The resolution was approved unanimously by both the House and the Senate. It describes the death of Heather Heyer, who was killed on August 12th in Charlottesville when a white supremacist drove a car into a crowd at the rally there. They called it an act of domestic terrorism. 19 others were injured in the car accident. In a separate attack, 20-year-old DeAndre Harris, who's African-American, was beaten by white supremacists. The resolution calls on the Department of Justice and other federal agencies to improve data collection on hate crimes. The resolution is headed to President Trump for his signature.
and calls on the administration to speak out against hate groups. But why is it that the White House yesterday would not say if Trump would sign it? That brings me up to another story. Let's talk about ESPN's Jemele Hill, because this ties in with that. Yesterday on Twitter, she was engaged in a back and forth with a number of different people, and she actually posted this. Donald Trump is a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists. Now, Hill's comments about Trump followed a post in which she reacted to an article about rocker Kid Rock attacking the media and extreme left for trying to label him a racist. Hill didn't mince words about her feelings toward Trump or the impact she thinks he's had on the nation. She tweeted, "Trump is the most ignorant, offensive president of my lifetime. His rise is the direct result of white supremacy, period. He has surrounded himself with white supremacists. No, they're not alt-right, and you want me to believe he isn't a white supremacist?" Now, Hill pointed to last month's violent white supremacist rally in Charlottesville as an example of how Trump has empowered America's white supremacists. Of course, ESPN reacted, saying they did have a conversation with her. They apologized. She did not. Many folks have come to her defense, including the likes of Reggie Miller and others who said, what did she say that was wrong? Of course, Fox News, they decided to get in the act, where Jesse Waters of Fox News said she should be making these comments because she has to understand her audience is largely white males. And then, of course, Tucker Carlson, he had to chime in as well. You know, two weasels who are afraid to actually have a debate with people like me because they really can't handle smart, educated black people, especially black men, when it comes to debate. Tucker and Jesse, y'all call me anytime when y'all ready to bring the funk. But then you probably don't want to get embarrassed on your own network. Real quick, go to our panel here. So here's the thing. Here's the thing. I understand the sentiment, understand the comments, and definitely people around them. But here's one of the reasons why I very rarely call someone a racist or white supremacist. Because what happens is the conversation is never about the issue.
Right. True.
It's about the label.
Right.
So when Paula White comes out and says, I know for a fact Trump is not a racist. See, I'm not going to have a debate with you about whether Trump is a racist or not.
Right.
I'm going to say, I need you to explain why Jeff Sessions wanted to get out of the consent decree. Right. I need you to explain the Voter Fraud Commission and its impact on voter suppression. I need you to explain why Trump wants to, in his budget, wants to get rid of the minority offices when it comes to job development. Right. I need you to explain this and this and this and this. So I'm going to lay out the body of work.
Right.
I need you to explain that as it relates to affecting black people versus the word.
Right.
It's difficult, you know, because we see Ta-Nehisi Coates, the new article he just published in The Atlantic, Donald Trump, America's First White President. He has the time and the space to lay that case out. It's another reason why it's important that News One Now is 2 hours. You have the time and the space now to do that. But we know that media is fickle. What Jemele said, things that we've said, and like you say, well, she said wrong. But when you do a quick burst like that, and you're dealing with short attention span world like the world of sports media, you're going to get that backlash. So, I mean, what you stress is very important. We got to go issue by issue, but you have to have time to develop that. And our reader and viewerships have to know you've got to really address this issue by issue. But when you do it like that, that's the responsibility.
And see, I've seen this debate happen. I've seen it on television all the time. And I've literally been there when I remember I was on CNN one time, and there was some comment Chris Matthews made. David. Not Axelrod.
Gergen.
He goes, you know, he's not racist. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't say he was. I said, plus, I'm not about to enter into that conversation, because then that becomes the conversation, as opposed to exactly what the issue is. Yeah. And so my deal is, I don't have to call Trump a white supremacist, but I will say, why did you employ Sebastian Gorka? Why did you employ Steve Bannon, who said that Breitbart is the home of the alt-right? Why are you employing Stephen Miller, who Richard Spencer, the white supremacist, said was his role model at Duke? Explain that.
Yeah, I agree. I think the labels start to invoke a lot of emotion and gets us away from some really important issues that we need to be discussing. I mean, we still have health care that's just looming out there. We're having a discussion now about what's going to happen with tax reform. And I think that the labels, again, in a short period of time, distract from the major issues And
so labels aren't legitimate, though, you all in Charlottesville?
No. Follow me here.
I understand the Trump piece.
Follow me here. See, I'm going to call white supremacists. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, when it becomes, whether political leaders, whether it comes media folks or whatever, what happens is we normally are debating what somebody said or did.
Which was she was doing.
Right. And then what happens is we say, the person is this.
That's exactly right.
So what happens is, if you disagree, you're not debating what they said the person has done. You start debating, well, how do you, like, for instance, like when I start saying Trump lies, mm-hmm. people, they say, well, no, semantics mean, they would say, no, what it means is you can't call him a liar. Because you have to know their intent.
Right, that's a semantics type of debate.
That becomes a debate opposed to the lie they told.
So, Rome, let me ask you, how do you handle the response? Because you're exactly right. The example you gave from the debate with Gergen and also with Jemele Hill. In responding, how should media figures do that?
Easy. It's going to say, I would simply say, why did he hire this person, this person, this person, who are all identified white supremacists?
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if that's not who you are and that's not what you like, why would you employ those individuals?
Yeah. There it is.
Boom. See, so it's very simple. So if you say you're not anti-Semitic, why would you employ people who make anti-Semitic comments as it relates to folks who are Jewish? See, they can't get around that.
Right.
But see, the moment you hit them with the label,
right.
then they say, why are you calling them that? No. Here's what they've done.
They become the
nobody victim. Wants to debate what they've done.
Goodness. Right.
They want to debate the label.
Yes.
Right. And that's how I play the game. So it's just, and that's why my deal is like, you ain't gonna catch me slipping.
No question.
No. It's like, we gonna debate the issue,
right.
not your little labels.
Yes.
Coming up next, we hear from Mars Kojo and Nicole R. Parker about what happens when you've been married 25 years and all of a sudden your marriage hits the rocks. Plus, what the hell? It's not what the hell Thursday. It's all what the hell when it comes to Trump. But it's Wild Night Wednesday. Our comedians are here for some fun. All that next, News 19 TV 1.
Don't leave.
My audience knows very well what we talk about.
I know the consequences.
A second hour of News 1 Now starts next.
Are you serious?
Don't you just love it when there's video?
News 1 Now continues on TV 1.
What if you were forced into marriage by your parents after a teen pregnancy, stayed married for 25 years, and then planned to finally go your separate ways? And worse, one of you wants to stay together. Well, that's the premise of a new TV One movie, Downsize, starring Boris Kojo and Nicole Ari Parker. I caught up with them at the American Black Film Festival, where they had their families with them, and we kicked our conversation off with them talking about their kids and how basically their kids are like, look, y'all go on about your business. We trying to have some fun here in Miami.
We're here at ABFF with the movie Downsize for TV One. We are really excited to be here. We love the festival and we love this film.
Y'all got the whole crew here.
Yes, so y'all brought the kids.
So it's like a whole crew thing because so you were saying that what? So y'all kids, Sally and Dondre's kids,
yep.
Chris Spencer and his
Vanessa. Yeah.
So
yes.
Y'all kids like, look, we good. Y'all go along. Go along.
I picked them up last night around midnight. They didn't want to leave.
Yeah.
You know, go. Yeah. No, we don't want to go. So they're having a good time.
So much fun. The beach, the pool.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's always a good thing when there's something else for you. Like, okay, we can be grown.
Yes.
So y'all got your own people y'all can hang out with. Mm-hmm. We got our people we can hang
exactly.
out with.
Exactly.
And then everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to work your way there because now they're old enough so they can hang out with their friends. But,
yes.
you know, 5 years ago,
with
they
supervision.
Were.
Supervision. Mean, we didn't just drop them off with some Cheerios and be like.
Call Here's the room
if
key.
You need me. No.
Call 911 if something happens.
Well, that's always a good thing when kids get older because you be like, okay, y'all got this.
Mm-hmm.
I can think back to the number of times my parents left. It was me, my brother, my sister, my two young sisters.
No, back in the day.
And
no.
We were straight up, I mean, I'm talking about, 12, 13, 14.
No seatbelts, everybody smoked.
No, it was very simple.
You had your own house key.
Lock the damn door. Don't unlock the door. It was it. I mean, those were the rules.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you knew, don't go near that door.
Yeah.
Don't peep out the window.
Yeah. That's funny.
That was always a deal.
Oh, my gosh. Dinner's on the stove,
huh?
Right?
Oh, no, no. Yeah. No. We raised a cook.
Oh, raised a cook, yes.
Oh, no. We had to cook.
Yep.
Same thing?
Mm-hmm. Sophie can cook.
Same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Sophie can cook,
I had to
yes.
cook, too.
Yeah, no, all that stuff, waiting on them to cook, no. We were baking at 7, cooking at 8.
There you go.
Because my mom had a cake company, so she baked.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was cool. So by the time we were 12, we're like, all right, we straight. It's like, y'all go ahead. Plus, the beauty of cooking is you can eat what you want to eat. So when you later get mad, you ain't got to lie when it ain't good. It's like, and I'm going to go ahead.
I got this, baby. I got it.
I'm going to go ahead and cook.
Yep.
Why do you keep saying that?
Because it's true.
What's interesting to me about marriage and family and all of that is that I don't care who you are. I don't care what level you're on. There are basic things people go through.
It's all the same.
Whether it's children, whether it's things like cooking, whether it's whatever, that, whether we want to own up to it or not, causes friction. Sometimes there's small friction, whether or not, did you really wash my clothes on hot when that tag says warm? Yeah, I had to deal with that. Cause you know, when the pants were shrunken, I'm like, okay, but that tag said warm. I don't read tags, but that's why there's a tag.
In three languages.
Right there. So it's like, I got this. So, but then there are other moments when things get far more serious that a lot of people don't want to deal with.
Well, I think that's the key right there, because a lot of people, when they get married, they don't use challenges and obstacles as an opportunity to grow. They use it as an excuse to walk out the door.
Yep.
And I think that, and that's what the movie talks about. The movie talks about a couple committing to being together for the next 25 years. They were teenage parents. And then after 25 years, they decide, look, are we going to keep this going? Are we going to go separate ways? And for us personally, I think it was always a big deal that we wanted to give each other the opportunity to grow through adversity and through challenges.
Yes.
And because, you know, when you get together, you're two individuals.
Yep.
From two different places.
It's
two different backgrounds.
225 pounds of challenge.
And what I tell people is,
225. Why you gotta put out the weight? Wow, she's got.
Right,
she's going.
That was some shade. That was
225 pounds of solid German high performance vehicle. Is what I'm talking about.
Oh, I thought she. I would take another way. I was like, 225. You're being generous. I would have put it back on her.
Oh. he wants to,
if you're gonna throw the shade, you're like, okay. Baby, you shouldn't talk about stuff like that.
Why are you so eager to throw everything away?
It's important that you realize that, you know, you're individuals and you're gonna remain that. Yes, you work together. Yes, you create synergies. But a lot of people say we're gonna become one. No, you're not. You're not gonna become one. You're still gonna be you, and I'm still gonna be me.
Well, and what I say is, it's not 50-50. It's not. No, you're 100-100.
100-100.
I mean, so it's not. No,
absolutely.
Because it's not. It's not. Because
absolutely.
If you say it's 50-50, that means that you're half of a person.
Yeah.
But you're not. Mm-hmm. You're
I
a whole
like
person.
Absolutely.
And you bring all that comes to bear with it.
Well, after 12 years of marriage, I had to come face to face with a lot of things I brought to the relationship,
yes.
Which is, you get on my nerves up to a certain point. I am the rollout modern girl. You know, I can do this. Like, so when we were boyfriend and girlfriend, I was always like, and you know what I mean? Like, I didn't have that skill for that, you know, level of respecting where we are. Mm-hmm. I always had that option. And then there's something that happens, A, when you get married, and then when you have children, that option just flew out the door. Mm-hmm. I couldn't just get mad, slam the door, all those things. And so I was still working with, we are 100 together. Sometimes I'm 70 and you're 30, 60, 40. Sometimes in a good relationship, you think 50-50. But this is deep, that part of the next journey is making sure I'm 100.
That comes first.
And that he's 100, and then we work together.
You two will finish school and establish yourselves. Your father and I will help raise the baby.
So when I think about this movie, and we all know historically, people we know and family members, individuals who have had kids, at 17, 18, they got married. They got married so young that they never ever knew who they were.
That's a very real thing.
Then they go down that road, because as you said also earlier, when you have kids, one of the big, and again, my wife and I do not have kids, but we raised six of my nieces. And one of the things that I have witnessed with brothers and sisters and other people is that they never make the point when they say, oh, hold up, we were here before they were here.
Oh, we say that all the time.
And then people go, oh my God, you're pushing your kids away. It's like, no.
It's not the same
but
thing.
But if this ain't tight.
That won't be tight.
That won't
work out. We remind each other a lot of that very thing. Remember, we were here first? Because we want to make sure that this is strong.
That's right.
because everything else falls into place after that.
Yeah.
So we're very much aware of that.
It's not easy, though, very in real time. Aware. It's not. I
no.
mean, there's basketball games and
ballet recitals
and
homework and
projects and travel and work.
Okay, so it's interesting. So if I take the title of this movie, Downsized.
Yes.
Have you ever said to the kids, y'all doing too much?
Too
because what happens is you take kids and it's school, it's ballet, it's basketball,
piano.
It's all this sort of stuff. And then next thing you know, you're on the treadmill and you're just constantly being scheduled. Versus you say, no. You need to pick one thing you're gonna do in terms of pullback. In terms of
we do that with each other.
Yeah.
Like, you need to. There's no more airplanes in the next 2 weeks of your life, 3 weeks of your life. There was a point, Roland, just a month ago, he had been to 4 different countries in 2 weeks. Countries. And he got home and he wasn't himself. Mm-hmm. And so and he's doing it for work, for his family. And so I said, we're good. Like, it's okay, you know, delegate some of that responsibility out. Mm-hmm. And so we take care of each other that way.
TV One Movie Downsize airs this Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central. So be sure to check it out. All right, y'all, it is Wildin' Out Wednesday. Y'all know we're going to have some fun.
Yeah.
Time for our comedians. Oh, Country Miss Gail is here. Y'all see her? I know she brought some ham hocks with her from the country.
Yeah.
That's next, News One on TV One.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, y'all, it's Wednesday, which means our comedians in the house. Wildin' Out Wednesday. Lots of crazy stories, crazy comedians. We have... oh, my God. Jesus.
Just go ahead and try. Just try.
Greenwood turnip seed.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Junior.
I know damn well you can in the country, Miss Gale.
I bought my turnip seed with me, baby, because I'm going to have them turnip greens.
Desi Alexander. What the hell is this? Like,
it's
the Beverly Hillbillies? What is going on?
Ain't your middle name Sebastian?
Sebastian. That ain't from the country. That ain't from the country.
We got Beverly from Beverly Hillbillies, okay? So don't go there for us. We're the Blackbird. We the Black people.
We're
the Beverly Hillbillies, okay?
Not the Beverly Hillbillies.
Y'all Baldwin Hills Hillbillies.
Baldwin Hillbillies.
I'm not from D.C., but I'm from D.C., deep country, okay?
Socialite.
Right. Hey, have y'all ever seen the country Muslim? Look right there.
Hey!
Look right there. Assalamu alaikum with some ham hocks and greens.
Hey, y'all.
Oh, my God.
Chicken can make a ham hocks. That's all right. It ain't the smell.
I was sitting like,
really?
I don't know how you're going to take it.
Haywood turnips.
How you going to get it? Okay, mine's is easy. Mine's is simple.
Yeah. Yours is simple?
Desi Alexander.
Right, right. Where country down there.
Sound like a football.
Reading England, the 53-year-old Simon Smith decided that he would take a walk to his local bar for a pint. As Smith walked to the bar, something out of the ordinary happened. He was hit by a bus.
Hey.
Wow. You know what?
Y'all.
You know what?
That's not supposed to happen.
No. It get better. Unfazed.
Wow. Just got up like
my man casually dusted himself off, got up, and proceeded to the bar and had a drink.
Wow.
Had a pint.
Nobody got arrested.
His relationship is in shame.
The driver's been suspended.
Oh, my God.
Way to go,
bro. Investigation.
Whoa.
What is it?
Up,
like, what? I mean, he got titanium in his spine?
Yes.
That was a Harry Potter driver.
He's one of that is crazy.
Wow. And the bus didn't stop.
The bus kept going. He got right on the red line.
Oh, he's a modern-day Wolverine.
You sure that's not DC?
That is Adam Matthew.
That's crazy.
People in Southeast that happens to quite often.
They get hit and just bounce right back up.
I got to get a drink. Okay, I got a mission. I'm on. I got to get this drink. He got right back up. It's all good.
He had to have something in him.
Right. I mean, you can't get hit by a bus.
I'm telling you, get back.
Hold up. That wasn't a tap.
That was the magic school bus.
That was a tap. Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
That was not a love tap.
Lord, John.
But see, I laid there. How you going to get a lawsuit? I'd have stretched out right there.
He was black. I'm saying.
He wasn't about to
lie. He was so glad he was alive.
Damn well, he wasn't black.
He wanted that pint. He wanted that pint. That's how they do across the pond.
You know he wasn't black because he was black. A black mama would have came out, whooped his ass, and said, see, you walk in the damn street. You know, doggone well.
Exactly. Bus company, I'm like, all right, I want $5 million
now. Only black people can have somebody hit by a bus and your mama still whoop your ass. You walk in the street.
My neck and my back.
Mama said, you dead? If you not, I'm going to kill you.
Precisely. Mess up your school clothes.
He just messed up a scholarship fund for somebody.
I've seen many a black kid snatched to be look both ways walking down the street.
That hurt more than the bus.
Yes, it is.
I've seen that. I'm kind of like, okay, yeah. My wife has just snatched my nieces.
Get back over here.
Oh, yeah, no, don't play that.
See, black mamas invented the snatch. Yeah. See, they didn't know what they had. Snatch a knot in you. Grandma mama died, snatch a knot in you, honey.
Yes. Black mamas do it with a word.
Oh, yeah. especially the country black mamas.
Grit teeth.
Snatch has dual meaning.
Yeah. Back over here.
I went ahead and said it. You ain't really love a brother. I'm just saying.
But you know, Roland, I wasn't sure you was gonna be here because you been gone somewhere. I be watching you every day, Roland. Mm-hmm. So I know you here and there. So I was like, okay, he don't love me no more. But when they call me, I said, Roland still loves me.
Oh, Roland,
I love you so much.
I'm gonna
she don't bring that peach cobbler.
Well, I didn't know.
As a song goes, it takes a fool to learn love don't love nobody. Hey. All right, I gotta take a break. I'll be back. News One Now, TV One.
Your centerpiece for black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Hashtag HBCU Giving Day. Today's school, Talladega College, located in Talladega, Alabama. Their vision is to prepare students for both graduate studies and making a difference in the global community. Give to Talladega, talladega.edu/give.asp. I say give ASAP. Birthday shout out time. Music producer Swizz Beatz turns 39 years old.
Showtime.
His wife, Alicia Keys, shout out to her. Actor director Tyler Perry turns 48. Talk show host Tevin Smiley turns 53. And Iyanla Van Zandt turns 64. Real quick, where are you performing?
Baltimore Comedy Factory tomorrow night and Sunday at the 10 Tigers.
Giga, where are you performing? Be on the phone.
I have my Sunday Funnies on September the 24th. Laughing Lenny is the headliner. You all come in Fredericksburg, Virginia, Liberty Laughs Comedy Club.
Turn up seat.
DC Draft House tonight, performing with Alex Scott, A Night of Fun.
Yes.
Come on through.
Yes. Oh, Alex, how much weight he lost now? I gotta go. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.